Welcome. I'll call the meeting to order of March 17th. Please rise and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic which stands one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We have a roll call of members.
Yes. Mr. Stevenson?
Present.
Mr. Burbank?
Here.
Ms. Cha?
I'm here.
Mr. Dennis?
Here.
Mr. Hattery?
Here.
Ms. Herrera? Ms. Kiefer?
Present.
Ms. Mackesy?
Here.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne?
Present.
Mr. Proto?
Here.
Mr. Randall has asked to be excused. Ms. Robertson?
Here.
Mr. Shinagawa has also asked to be excused. Mr. Sigler?
Here.
Mr. Kaplinka-Lehrer?
Present.
12 members present.
Thank you. Petitions, communications, and notices.
Communications are on the desks.
Thank you. We have two proclamations. I'll start with one. It's World Water Days for UNICEF. I think Mac Larson is here to receive it if you want to come up while I read it. Whereas the United Nations General Assembly in December of 1992 designated the 22nd of March of each year as the international observance of World Water Day, and whereas approximately 90 million people do not have access to clean water, and the effects on children are devastating, with 1.2 million children under the age of 5 dying each year as a result of not having clean water or adequate sanitation facilities, and water-related diseases kill a child every 18 seconds. And whereas for a period which includes the date of March 22nd, the U.S. Fund for UNICEF has brought to Ithaca and Tompkins County the TAP Project, a campaign that celebrates the clean and accessible drinking water available in the United States while helping UNICEF provide safe water for children around the world. And whereas access to safe water is essential to sustain human life and is considered a basic human right, and UNICEF is already working in 90 countries throughout the world to secure that right. Now, therefore, I, Michael Kaplinka-Lehrer, Chair of the Tompkins County Legislature, do hereby proclaim the period of March 22nd until April 7th, 2009, as World Water Days for UNICEF in Tompkins County, and encourage all residents to use only as much water as they need and to work together to help ensure that all people throughout the world have equitable and affordable access to clean water. Thank you, Matt. Mac, for bringing this to us, and I guess you have a word or two.
I want to give you a report on what happened last year when you issued a similar proclamation. We managed to raise about $2,400 in the Ithaca area last year. And that sounds like a rather piddling amount for Ithaca, but I hope we'll do better this year, but I don't know. However, UNICEF's multiplier factor is 40 days of water for every dollar, and so that amount bought 86,000 days of clean water to people in great need. Now, they raised an awful lot more than just that. And there is a difference between the proclamation tonight and the proclamation last year in numbers, where tonight it reads 1.2 million children are expected to die this year from polluted water. Last year it read 1.5 million. A 300,000 person drop. And that's quite an achievement. It's that kind of achievement for UNICEF is what makes a certain Millennium Development Goal adopted by the United Nations in the year 2000 within reach. That goal was to cut, one of eight goals, that one was to cut the child mortality rate in half by the year 2015. Most of the Millennium Development Goals are going to require extensions of time, but this one is within reach. So I thank you, and I'm going to just let these go around, and if you feel inclined to take one, please do. And here's something that says, what can churches do? Well, whether you're a church or not, you might get some ideas from it.
Thank you again, Matt. We have a second proclamation for Earth Hour in Tompkins County, so whoever's here to receive it, if someone is here. Julie, do you want to take it on behalf of the community?
Of the Earth?
Of the Earth, yes. Whereas the first Earth Hour took place in March 2007 in Sydney, Australia, with more than 2.2 million people participating in an effort that darkened such iconic structures as the Sydney Opera House and the Harbour Bridge, and resulted in a 10% drop in energy usage, double what had been predicted. And whereas in 2008, Tompkins County citizens joined the effort via a proclamation from this legislature and subsequently voluntary actions by institutions such as Cornell University and Ithaca College and many individual residents. And whereas on Saturday, March 28th, 2009, from 8:30 p.m. to 9:30 p.m., many cities and countless individuals worldwide will turn off their lights for 1 hour as part of a global event symbolizing support for action on climate change. Now, therefore, I, Michael Kuplinka-Lehrer, Chair of the Tompkins County Legislature, do hereby proclaim the hour of 8:30 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. on March 28th as Earth Hour in Tompkins County, and urge all residents, businesses, institutions, and governments to participate in this symbolic act to demonstrate support for combating climate change, the gravest threat our planet has faced. Thank you. Thank you, Dooley, for bringing it to us. Here.
When the World Wildlife Fund started this idea 2 years ago, global warming seemed somewhat controversial. I think by now it really isn't anymore. So it may seem trivial to show your support by turning off lights for an hour. But I think it isn't. And it would be nice if we could get our local utility to measure how much less demand there is during that hour. Maybe we'll be able to figure out how to do that this year. We weren't able to get it done last year. One of the neat things that happened last year was actually at Cornell, where there is a big sustainability team and they're doing a lot of relevant things, but the athletic department rescheduled its workout at Shelcoff Field to make it earlier in the day so they wouldn't have those bright, bright lights on during the hour last year. I thought that was a good example of creative thinking.
Thank you. We have no announcements of special orders of the day, so we'll move on to privilege of the floor for the public. Three members have passed in these little blue sheets, but if others want to speak, you're welcome to come to the mic. The first speaker, Bethany Schroeder, it looks like. State your name and where you live in Tompkins County, and you have about 3 minutes.
Thank you. My name is Bethany Schroeder. Can you hear me?
Yes.
And I live in the town of Ithaca in Tompkins County. As I say here in my document, which I'd like entered into the record, my name is Bethany Schroeder, and I'm a volunteer with the Ithaca Health Alliance and Free Clinic. I also serve as the president of the Board of the Directors. Last month, I addressed the Tompkins County Legislature in behalf of the members and patients we serve. In my comments, I briefly reviewed the 11-year history of the Health Alliance and our 3 years of work at the Free Clinic. Today, I'd like to give you an update that focuses on trends we are more recently beginning to understand. In January and February of this year, we served 175 and 176 patients, respectively, in each of those 2 months. Our general clinic operations are available on Mondays and Thursdays. Physicians cared for between 8 and 22 patients each shift, depending on the day of the week. Although we did not typically turn patients away, our physicians were required to see patients beyond normal hours, meaning they got home late, as did the rest of our volunteers and staff. In addition to general medical services, our volunteer ancillary clinicians and complementary and alternative practitioners provided services including chiropractic, herbal therapy, acupuncture, physical and occupational therapy, nutritional consultations, and nursing care. Unless a patient canceled at the last minute for one of these services, our volunteers were busy every minute of every clinic shift. Furthermore, roughly two-thirds of the patients we saw during both months were new to the clinic. On the one hand, we are fulfilling our covenant with those who helped establish the free clinic and with those for whom we wanted to provide care. On the other hand, we are at full capacity, and we are increasingly challenged to serve all the area residents who visit us. Clinic visitors include the homeless, the jobless, and the many working people who simply do not make enough money to purchase health insurance or else make just a little too much to qualify for state insurance. On discharge from the clinic, we conduct a short interview with each patient in hopes of improving care and identifying trends. In February alone, 30 of the 176 patients who visited the clinic said that had the clinic not been open, they would have sought care at the emergency room or convenient care center. Since these 30 patients did not have the funds to pay for care, we estimate that the burden to the local health delivery system would have amounted to a minimum of $12,000. In keeping with this development, donated memberships through the Ithaca Health Alliance for the modest profile of services our members support is markedly up, especially since the last quarter of 2008. By the end of 2007, for example, 17 patients, or people, excuse me, had received donated memberships, whereas from October to the end of 2008, just a few months, 26 people received these memberships. Fortunately, one of the area's local businesses made money available to the Health Alliance in order to increase the number of donated memberships to the community at large. We cannot help wondering how long this level of generosity will be available, or when our neighbors, friends, and fellow residents will get relief from the many economic burdens they bear. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Bethany. The next speaker is Pete Myers.
Everybody, my name is Pete Myers. I live in the city of Ithaca and I'm with the Tompkins County Worker Center. I'm here tonight to speak on behalf of a resolution that you will be dealing with tonight. It's called the Fair Share Tax Reform Resolution. And I'm very grateful for the resolution being brought forward to the legislature tonight. I think many people here know that the state is facing a $13 billion shortfall this year in its budget, which is going to affect many things in terms of schools, healthcare providers, other essential community services, and that in essence those cuts, the way the executive budget is now targeting these cuts, is in essence a tax upon working class people. And I think that we really need to pay hard attention to this and look at the Fair Share Tax Reform Bill, which is now in the State Assembly and the Senate. This bill would essentially raise the taxes on the top 5% of New York's population. It would raise about $6 billion, which would be about half of what the governor is now proposing with $13 billion cut. So I just ask you to really look in your hearts, make a strong statement on behalf of Tompkins County, and support this important resolution. Thank you.
Thank you, Pete. And Teresa Ault has signed up.
I'm here also to speak on behalf of, in favor of the resolution supporting fair share tax reform in the state. Most of the information that would be needed is right in the resolution. It's pretty self-explanatory. But I can add a couple of things. Back, I remember the 1970s, the first era of the bell bottoms, when New York State taxes were far more in tune with what people could afford to pay. And let me say, it was a good time, and there were a lot of state services, and the state sent money to local governments to do essential things like education and road maintenance and welfare. Things that once tax cutting for the uppermost brackets began got shifted to the property tax and the sales tax. And those two taxes come down with rather little regard to whether the individual they hit is able to pay them. The sales tax, there seems to be a kind of practical limit on how high it can go. Property taxes seem to be the ones that go up. Homeowners scream. The state instituted the STAR program to give some relief to homeowners. But guess what? That leaves renters out. And, of course, while landlords may write the check for the property taxes on their properties, they don't pay the property taxes. They pass them right on to the renters. So you have the situation where a really low-income renter in a very modest apartment could nevertheless be paying 50% of income for rent, and that happens. We know that happens around here. And of that 50%, 25% could very well be going, passing right through to the state as property tax. Where did I get that 25%? From state tax form IT-214. It happens to be estimated there. And so while the resolution mentions that the bottom 20% of New Yorkers pay 12.6% of their incomes in state and local taxes because the property tax rises to meet what isn't covered by the state income tax, for some really low-income people, 12.5% or 12.6% could be the property tax alone. It's a really unreasonable burden. Remember, you can't just move every time your income fluctuates. So property tax, a very blunt instrument and something there should be far less reliance on as people who have to raise money from the property tax. You know this. And as I said, fair share tax reform, everything is that you need to know is in the resolution. Read it and pass it.
Thank you, Teresa. Those are folks who signed up in advance, but others who may want to speak are welcome to. If there's no one, we'll move on to privilege of the floor for legislators. Mike Hattery has the Youth Award. We'll start with Mike.
Young ladies, come on down. And Tom and Mom. Right before Christmas, there was a tragedy this year that we're going to celebrate a positive outcome tonight. I'm going to read a nomination letter from Ron Flynn, who's the past fire chief at Neptune Hose Company in Dryden, for nominating these two young ladies as for our Youth Award this month. I'm pleased and proud to nominate two fine young women for the Tompkins County Distinguished Youth Award. The house fire we had Christmas Eve morning at the Susan Cornelius residence on Ringwood Road could have been a whole lot worse were it not for the quick thinking and life-saving efforts of Megan Cornelius, age 14, and her younger sister, Emily Morse, age 10, both from Dryden. Megan discovered the fire, and we might have the details slightly messed up. Megan discovered the fire, got her younger sister out of the house, and reported the fire. Emily had been upstairs in her room, which eventually became involved with fire. Once out of the house, Emily joined Megan in walking the person occupying the basement apartment and getting him out of the house. All this happened within a very short time. Megan and Emily's efforts saved lives. If it were not for their very mature and calm actions, This fire could have produced tragic results with a fatality involved. I'm extremely proud to nominate Megan Cornelius and Emily Morse for the Distinguished Youth Award. If that isn't an example of keeping cool and exercising courage in the face of a fearful and dangerous situation, I don't know what is. The current chief's here. I didn't know if you wanted to add anything.
Thanks. Hello, everyone. I'm Tom Warner, current chief of Dryden Fire Department, Neptune Hills. The girls learn this at school. It just shows the importance of public education for fire safety. And they did everything perfect. They couldn't have done a better job. So I applaud both of them. Very good job.
And Mom asked that a note be read. You want to read that?
Mike, move it.
Yeah.
We would like to thank you for this award. We would like to thank the Dryden Volunteer Fire Department for their time spent in our school teaching us what to do in the event of a fire.
We believe that it was this training along with our family plan for evacuation that saved our lives on December 24th, 2008.
Now, given the fact that you worked as a team, I was thinking we should give you just one award, but Kathy was wiser, and we have one for each of you. This one's for you, Megan.
Thank you.
And tell me who the sponsors are. This is an award that's actually sponsored jointly by the legislature, Purity Ice Cream,
Bangs
Ambulance,
Cougar Radio.
And Cougar Radio Group. So there's a few more goodies here, except the ice cream things. I want to keep those.
All right.
Thank you.
Before you leave, this situation, I don't know. Every once in a while, something causes you to write, and those of you who may want to pray for me not to follow the urge next time after you hear this. But I was thinking about firefighters, and one in particular, former Chief Ron Flynn, couldn't make it tonight. And so I wrote this little ode to firefighters. Here's to you, firefighters, an educator, emergency responder, do anything the community asks, volunteer person. You somewhat crazy man or woman who thinks you can work your job 60 hours a week, get in all your training requirements, go to meetings, maintain your equipment, do your practice drills, hold fundraisers, have open houses so little kids can climb on your equipment, spend your holidays in parades throwing candy and beeping your horn, fight silly municipal officials, elected officials, to fund that equipment they don't think you need, put up with outrageous state regulations, take the initiative to make needed changes, put up with other firefighters, have a home life, maybe sleep, and keep us all feeling safe and secure, because we know that no matter what the time of day or night or weather conditions, you'll knock yourself out to get to our house and help us when we're in crisis. Here's to you, because you actually do all these things, and we thank you.
Thanks, Michael. Are there other legislators who wish to speak under privilege of the floor? Frank Proto?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think on behalf of all the volunteer firefighters and those that are paid, I think the community really deserves to thank all of you for all your service. I think that letter really depicts what all of us appreciate, believe me. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
You bet. Thank you. I wanted to draw your attention to an article that was in the paper here this past week with regard to Senator Schumer, and thank him for picking up the ball on the inquiry regarding excess electric rates. I really think, it's relentless with me because of the concerns that I have about costs. But the Public Service Commission is currently, once again, looking at the proposed increase that the Iberdrola is asking for with regard to NYSEG. It flies in the face of what the original purchase included, and I would urge anyone and anyone who's listening to consider writing a letter to the PSC if they're very concerned about this proposed increase. My recollection is it would translate into about a $200 to $250 increase per household account that is using the electric. So anyway, just a heads up. For those of you that celebrate St. Patrick's Day, I'd like to make sure that it doesn't go unnoticed that those of us that are Italian look forward to St. Joseph's Day, which isn't too far away. I think it's tomorrow. So that's as important a holiday for some of us. And just one personal aside here. Those of us that sit around this table provide a lot of information to the public. I mean, we wait for an opportunity to speak on the privilege of the floor for our sometimes 2 hours, and sometimes Mike tries to shut us up a little bit sooner than that. But I had a constituent of mine in Brooktondale mention that he hasn't had so much fun eating popcorn and watching us. And I asked him, Ben, is it a slow night? He said, you don't have any idea how interesting it is to watch you folks instead of the soaps. So from Brooktondale, we're getting some good positive results, and we're providing good information. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Anyone else wish to speak? Martha?
I got a card about a meeting coming up on natural gas drilling, very important. Thursday, March 26th, 7 to 9:15 p.m. They'll have light refreshments starting at 6:30. This is the speaker's going to be Albert Appleton, former New York City Commissioner of Environmental Protection. Presentations also by people from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability. Sponsored by Barbara Lifton and others. And this will be very interesting, important. They'll be talking about water resource management and environmental management of watersheds and rural landscapes, related to the gas drilling that we're concerned about. The DEC issued their draft scope, right? A couple weeks ago, and PDEQ heard got a memo from Scott Doyle in the Planning Department sort of summarizing what was actually in the draft scope and but mostly the things that we had asked to be included that aren't included. So I think probably everybody will be getting that memo. But I wanted to really also highlight an article in the paper recently, a headline, New York understaffed to handle gas rush. And it's pretty disturbing. One of the things that we did have in our resolution that went to the DEC that they said they couldn't comment on was about staffing in DEC to oversee the permits and oversee the drilling. There are 19 employees, according to this article, 19 employees in the Bureau of Oil and Gas Regulation in the DEC, and they're the ones, all 19 of them, who will have to handle, as it says in the article, handle a rush of permits and intensive drilling activity on this side of the border, meaning with Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania has already has a larger staff and a hiring freeze. However, they're hiring 37 new people to deal with their oversight of drilling in the Marcellus Shale. As of now, there are no provisions in the proposed state budget to the DEC staff to oversee this. And according to Assemblywoman Donna Lepardo from Endwell, we are waiting to hear from the governor's office on what direction to take. So upcoming meeting on March 26th, did I say the location? At the Ithaca High School cafeteria. And I hope that that we'll be taking a stand at some point soon on the need for sufficient staffing to oversee this. I think the funds for that could come from the severance tax that we also mentioned in our resolution. So I hope it's something we will watch.
Thank you, Martha. Carol Chalk?
Yeah. I just wanted to, something that came up at the last meeting and that I've gotten questions about related to the affordable housing MOU that I thought should be cleared up because I think there's some maybe some misunderstandings. Tompkins County's support for affordable housing will be for new and rebuilt high-quality homes and apartments that will add to the tax base and that should enhance rural and urban neighborhoods. When we talk about affordable housing, especially in the context of workforce housing, we're not really talking about people at the very bottom. We're not talking about those who can't make ends meet, although that's also a need that and an issue that we need to be aware of and figure out ways to address. But I just want us to be clear that that's not the real target of the Affordable Housing Initiative. This is housing really for the bedrock of America. People who are working, have a modest income, want to buy into the American dream, and who will be able to do so with the assistance at the beginning. These are people who can afford a good, solid middle-class house with some assistance. Those who buy houses under the housing trust portion of what we pass will be people who've been able to qualify to make regular mortgage payments, to pay insurance, to pay taxes that they will owe, and who will understand that they've made an investment and care that they maintain that investment. The Housing Assistance Fund, which is the other half of that, will be to help design and plan rental or ownership projects of a similar nature for that kind of target population. And these projects will all add to the tax base in the county. When Better Housing, INHS, and others buy, rehab, and sell homes or rent them, these are often the highest quality homes on the block or in the rural neighborhood. These organizations are in the business of improving the housing stock. Their financing helps people who can achieve the homeownership dream once given that initial leg up, or who can then afford to renovate and fix up the homes they already own. And again, the point is to enhance neighborhoods. And I thought it might be good, we probably should have done this before, but at some point it might probably would be worth it at the beginning of one of our meetings to ask INHS and Better Housing and others if they're in the business, come to us without a lot to say, but just their slides, their before and after slides of the kinds of things that they do, because it really is astounding what they manage to achieve. So I just wanted to say that and make sure that we all understood for ourselves how this will work.
Thank you, Carol.
And happy St. Patrick's Day to any of us who are celebrating it.
Thank you. Are there other legislators who wish to speak under privilege of the floor? Greg Stevenson?
I just wanted to take a quick minute to thank Legislator Hattery for recognizing the fire company in Dryden while he was doing his presentation for the Distinguished Youth Award. It's always nice to see local emergency providers recognized by their municipal officials. I think that means a lot to firefighters in general. I just note with a wee bit of sadness that in some municipalities, the arguing with municipal officials part and the fundraising for equipment they don't think you need probably need to be a little higher on your list. And that's somewhat sad. But thank you for that, Mike. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Greg. Anyone else wish to speak? Martha.
Just briefly also about the housing program, that the county's share of that is not coming from property tax, this sort of, or contingent fundraising. This was a little bit also confused in some media reports. This is from HUD money that's basically been recycled from the home ownership program. These are payments that people are paying back after they've gotten their low-cost loan. And it's money that's been set aside. And if we didn't use it for some kind of housing-related purpose, the feds would take it back. So it's not property tax money. Basically came from the feds.
Thanks. If there are no further legislators wish to speak, I see no municipal officials here, so we'll move on to our special presentation from Carl Haynes, State of the College Address, Tompkins Courtland Community College. We're actually on track to kind of wrap up in about an hour if we can deal with the presentation and only two resolutions tonight that are not on consent. So I think we can...
Don't say that.
Keep focusing.
Never say that.
Don't fill the time if you don't have to.
Thank you, Michael. I'm passing around a copy of my annual report, and there are extra copies in addition to the those available for the legislators so that they could be here in the county office and for others that may want to access them. And for those listening in, if anyone in the listening audience tonight wants a copy, why you just call my office in the college and be happy to get one out to them. Again, thanks for the opportunity to kind of share a little bit of the state of the college. I'm not going to go through the first half of the report. I'm going to comment on my report in a couple of minutes. But part of what I wanted to address, I think, tonight, we are in kind of very unusual times. Excuse me, usual times. And in contrast to the challenges that other higher education institutions, Cornell and Ithaca College, are facing with cutbacks, declining revenue sources from endowments, declining state resources and consequent layoffs, our challenges are quite different. And so I just wanted to kind of outline a little of that for you and then talk a little bit about some of the directions we're taking, some of the highlights from that report, and try to do all that in 10 minutes. First, the good news. The good news, I think, in terms of what we're the challenges we're facing at the college is that our enrollments are growing, and in fact, they're growing fairly significantly. The two factors, of course, we are a low-cost option for people wanting to access higher education, and that's getting higher on the radar screen for a lot of families who might be looking at, traditionally may have looked at other options and are now considering a community college is what I would refer to as that smart start in higher education, where they can get their first 2 years with us and still go on to Cornell, IC, or other places. In addition, of course, the layoffs in the communities, we're getting a lot of people coming back to the college that have been laid off for retraining and so on. And that, as you would expect, and I know most of you around here kind of are familiar with that, I'll comment a bit about that in just a minute as well. Last year, our enrollment grew by 8%. This year, we're looking at least at 6%. And next year, with the coming online of our additional residence halls, we're looking at someplace between 8 and 10%. If you add that up, that's between 20 and 25% growth over a three-year span. And actually, it's possible that next year, if we are on the upper end of that range, which we're not going to propose in our budget, it is within the realm of possibilities, but if we're on the upper end of that range, it's possible that we would hit 4,000 FTEs, which would be 100% growth in the last 12 years for the college. The positive side of our growth is that it does bring increased tuition revenue, so that's helping us in our challenge. And also, the important on the state side, I'll give you the bad part of the state side in just a minute, but on the positive side of the state side, they are funding all of our full-time equivalent students. You know, our state aid comes to us on a fixed rate per FTE, full-time equivalent student. And unlike a downturn that we experienced back in the 70s where they capped the number of FTEs that they would support at the college, the community college system, I should say, that's not the case now. They have been fully funding our FTE. So that's a positive sign because as we grow, it does give us some additional revenues, at least in our case. I need to point out that not all the community colleges are growing, so others are experiencing greater levels of hardship than we are. There is an impact on facilities, which we've addressed. You know about the new classrooms. We're expanding our cafeteria and so on. And our new curricula is also having a positive impact on enrollment. The challenges, first of all, the governor's proposed a 10% cut in our base aid rate. That's a $230 cut in the rate per FTE that we receive. The impact on that of that on us is $850,000 for next year. So that's significant in our budget. $850,000 some places is not a lot of money, but for us that's a lot of money. We aren't experiencing layoffs. We don't intend to lay anybody off. As a matter of fact, we're experiencing just the opposite kind of challenge. We need to be doing some additional hiring, and we're not sure we're going to be able to afford to do that. With that kind of enrollment growth, it's one thing to try to address the growth with adding some adjunct faculty or something to fill out the sections that we might be needing, but where the real crunch comes is in all the rest of the infrastructure. We have 80 full-time faculty approximately, but we have 280 employees. So the other 280 employees, you know, in financial aid and enrollment services and counseling, library, public safety, residence halls, and so on, feel the brunt of these additional almost 500 or 600 students over the course of the last 2 or 3 years. So we're taking initiatives on a lot of things to try to help relieve that. We've got a lean office initiative underway right now, trying to extract inefficiencies out of our various systems to try to provide people the opportunity through improved procedures to serve more students without having to rely on more staff and so on. Technology, of course, is a factor. We're not sure just how far we can go with that, but we are still making progress, and I think we'll continue to do so. I think in summary, community college enrollments do go counter-cyclical with the economy, so you know, as economies go down, our enrollments tend to go up, and unfortunately that always happens when the taxpayer resources we rely on are also going down, so it creates a challenge for all of us in these times. But we're trying to manage the growth, I think, as reasonably as we can, given the fact that two of our three partners, the state and the counties, are experiencing severe and some unprecedented challenges. From my standpoint, over the last 40 years of serving the college, why we've seen a lot of recessions come and go, and they always end eventually. And what we're really doing is trying to position ourselves to come out of this in the best possible way in terms of how we can serve our students and through them, of course, be serving our communities. Now, let me just kind of comment a bit on my annual report. We took a little bit different tack with that this year. Cut back a little bit on the amount of information about the accomplishments of last year. That kind of constitutes the first half of the report. And because we're celebrating our 40th anniversary, we have a little centerfold that kind of lays out a little timeline of the major events, really, in the life of the history. It was kind of hard to figure out what do we put in there and what do we not put in there, but we did what we did, and it gives you a little insight. It was kind of interesting that we all know that Connie Cook just passed away here recently, and that's her in the picture there that's breaking ground for the new campus back in 1972, I think that was. The picture on the front, after the ribbon cutting that opened the new college when we were in Groton, is the students walking into their first day of classes after that ribbon cutting. And then, of course, the other picture is some of our current students. What we did in the second half of the report, and I'll just comment on this briefly then open it up for questions, is to take a look at the future. You know, what were the six major driving, well, we identified six, but there were six kind of major drivers or pillars on which I think our last 40 years have kind of been built, and particularly some of the more recent years. And those pillars, I think, become drivers for us as we go forward into the next 20 or 30 or 40 years. And again, I'm just going to highlight very briefly for the sake of time here, but those pillars, first of all, the learning-centeredness of the college. A couple of highlights in there to highlight what we've accomplished and or where we're going with that is we did achieve a 10-year reaccreditation this year, which I think most of you know. We were applauded for the assessment work we're doing, and as a matter of fact, in the accreditation letter that we got, not only did we get a full 10-year, but they actually singled us out and using us as a role model for other colleges that are having difficulties in how to do assessment work. Going forward, we're working learning communities, which we've had some success with on campus. We're now moving those into our residence halls, so our students will be able to choose a room that kind of lines up on a floor that maybe has a particular kind of learning focus of interest, whether it's something in the outdoor area or multicultural or whatever the interest might be. And we're also looking at additional new curriculum in the realm of actively under consideration right now is new programs in entrepreneurship, performing arts, theater management, things of that sort. People is another driver. We have award-winning faculty and staff at the college. We have a number of sustainability initiatives underway. I can expand on that if there's interest. And a number of diversity initiatives underway as well. We just recently had a very successful program put on by the National Coalition Building Institute that worked with all our staff. And as a matter of fact, we had a half-day program where part of we had well over half of our, all of our employees attending. And 21 of our employees are going through a training, during the trainer program, which was a three-day weekend program. So to continue that initiative on campus going forward. The third pillar is our strength focus. We have a partnership with Gallup, which I've spoken to before. That's very key, as far as I'm concerned, to not only our organizational success, but also to the success for a lot of our students. And again, I can elaborate on that if there's questions. The global initiatives we have is a fourth pillar. We have our partnerships with over 60 different countries around the world. Last year, our global initiatives, our global enrollment grew by over 34%. 9% of our FTE base right now comes from people all over the world that come into our communities, and it provides a rich opportunity for our students who don't have that opportunity to travel to really get to know, engage, and work with and learn from people who are attending the college from other cultures, other countries. The fifth part of the pillar, of course, is partnerships. A lot of different ways that plays itself out. Our TC3.biz, where we serve over 40 corporate clients. Our foundation really is a partner. Most of you know the very generous support we've received from Arthur Kukas, who has provided us with now $3 million to fund a Pathways program, which reaches out to adult people in our community who believe that they can't afford higher education and have never been in college to have that opportunity to attend with a very generous $5,000 scholarship as a result of his support. We have 9 students in a pilot program with that. With the additional million that he provided to the foundation this year, eventually that will grow to about 60 students. When the stock market comes around, that will help immensely. The TC3 Tioga Place, and we're getting ready to develop a new expanded location in Cortland County. And, of course, our work with the WIBS, which I indirectly referred to earlier, but the only real benefit that community colleges in the country received from the stimulus package that was approved was the money that's coming to the local WIBS. And, of course, we have two that we work with. The Cortland WIB works is a joint one with Cayuga County, and, of course, then we have the one here in Tompkins County. So we've already had meetings where we've got the two WIB leaders working collaboratively to develop some programs with them that can serve both the communities that we're serving. And, again, I can elaborate if you'd like. Technology becomes the next driver, and, we are a 3-time national award winner in terms of how we use technology to support students and our teaching and our staff. But there's a lot of other exciting things going on. This whole social networking, Facebook and Twitter, and all these kinds of things. The Second Life things. There's just a lot of very exciting pedagogical uses for somebody. Some of the stuff I'm not getting. I got to get used to some of this myself. One of my daughters sent me an email and wanted me to get on Twitter, so I kind of signed up real quickly, and we had a conversation the day before that I. You have 150 characters, those of you who are familiar with Twitter. So I kind of wrote a little response to what we talked about the day before. And within seconds, my other daughter, who lives in Washington, D.C., going to college down there, they responded and said, "Dad, you're not supposed to say stuff like that on Twitter." So who knows? I don't know what I'm supposed to say or what I'm not supposed to say. But clearly we need to learn about that. And it's not necessarily all about what goes on in the classroom. It's also how we engage with students and keep students engaged with us, okay, in their learning environment at the college. So basically, in summary, TC3 is not in retreat. In these challenging times, we have a very talented and committed faculty and staff that are using the limited resources that we do have available, both public and private dollars, as effectively and efficiently as possible to assure success for our students. and our continued engagement with our community to assure their growth and vitality as well. So with that, I'd be happy to take on any questions that you might have or clarify anything that I've referenced here in my remarks.
Thank you, Carl. It's a real model for the nation that we have right in our community. Kathy.
I can't resist the temptation to segue on your talk about technology and confess that I took a computer class at TC3 in 1989, and it was a class in Fortran. For those that remember that old computer language.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for TC3, well, I'm still a little scared to log on to a computer, but TC3 made me able to do it in spite of my fear.
Well, we're going to be start offering some non-credit, short-term kind of courses in the social networking kinds of things. So for those of you that might be in my realm that really need a little education on what to do with Facebook and MySpace and all this kind of stuff, we're going to be doing some workshops on that.
I'm still pre-Twitter.
I know, me too.
Pam and then Jim.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to thank you, Carl, for coming and speaking with us. And I appreciate what you are doing at TC3 and the accomplishments that TC3 has made so far. I mean, community colleges, I'm just completely in favor of community colleges. They provide such an important educational opportunity in our communities. And we need to support them as much as we can because, as you were pointing out, at times when things are tough and you need our support, people turn to community colleges because they are an economical way for people to get a very good education. And I have known so many people where TC3 has been the doorway for them to many other careers, moving on to a different, a college. It's really an incredibly important part of our community, and I want to thank you.
Thank you.
Jim Dennis?
Very quickly, number one, thank you for all your work and everyone there. And number two, I noticed something on the news the other day, and they were talking about a community college somewhere in the country, and I didn't write it down, but they were involved in developing a curriculum for green construction, trying to train people to be involved in construction for green buildings, and that seemed like very interesting to me because of this community, if in fact we're thinking about that.
We actually have a grant to do the same thing. Okay. And we're working on it right now with our construction tech folks.
That's great. So. The third thing is, if you're going to go on Twitter and Facebook, make sure if you apply for a job maybe 10 years from now, that they're going to look back.
I know. Don't say anything.
Frank, that goes for you too.
Frank Proto, then Dooley Kiefer.
Carl, I have to compliment you on the not only the report, but the annual report. But I draw your attention to the front cover of that. I remember the day that Corvair was parked there.
You're talking about the car?
Yeah.
Okay.
Frank's Corvair.
I remember when we taught at Groton when we opened, and it was unbearably hot because there wasn't any air conditioning in that building. Yeah. And we had an exciting couple of years.
You actually could open windows in that building. So.
Say again?
I said you could actually open windows in that building.
In those days, you could.
Yeah, which you can't.
But this is great. Yeah. Come a long way. And Jim, what's Twitter?
I'll talk to you later.
I'm glad you didn't ask me that question.
That's what the birds do on the telephone wire. Dooley Kiefer.
Carl, you mentioned developing a location in Cortland County, similar to Tioga Place here. Have you picked a site?
Well. Yes and no. Okay.
Well, don't answer.
Well, I can. It was got leaked into the media in Cortland last week, I guess, while I was out of the country. So it's kind of out in the public that the county owns some buildings on South Main Street in Cortland, and we, which they have a proposal to. It's a long story. I don't know if you follow Cortland News or not, but there's a lot of history behind how the county came to own these particular properties. And they have a great deal of interest in wanting to trade our building that we now own for another county use, and in exchange for us getting that site, as long as they're thinking about or proposing to tear down the buildings that are on that site. So we'd wind up with just a flat piece of land in which to build a building. It wouldn't be financially feasible for us otherwise. So this is just starting through their legislative process, which will be going on actually later this week. And I'm kind of hopeful that we will get legislative support for that site and so on, because I think it's a lot of upside for us. We do have a couple of other locations that we've got to have active conversations going, and I would advise both of those other property owners that right now, the county site is kind of our number one choice. So that's kind of where we're at. If all goes well on the political side of things in the next few weeks, we would probably start down the path with our foundation again owning it, and probably not. Our target is to have something up and running by fall of 2010. So it's nothing that's going to happen real quick.
But we do need
more space over there. We got a little 3,500 square foot facility, which is half the size of one floor here in Tompkins County, and so we do need more space over there. The concept we have in mind parallels very much what's on our sixth floor here in Tioga Place, if you've been in our building, except with a little bit more space.
Thank you.
And for people who have comments or questions, Mike, then Martha, after Mike Hattery.
I just wanted to say I've always had a lot of respect for TC3's vitality and the quality of the team that leads TC3. And with the growth up there, I just want, since we're a co-sponsor with Cortland and the village and town of Dryden on the east end are the major hosts, I think they've really done a great job as they've been expanding, working with both town and village officials to make that transition good and continue to be the good neighbors they've always been.
Good. Thank you, Mike.
Martha, then Carol, then Leslie.
Yeah, in terms of working with the community, maybe you still do Friday nights, sort of the gym and athletic facilities are open for families. Is that... Mike, do you remember? I know it had been.
I think we have a community swim. I mean, the swim.
Community swim, and I think the other athletic facilities too, and just a great opportunity for local families to go up there on a Friday night. My question is about green jobs, and I know the workforce investment, our WIB, Julie Maddox, expects quite a bit of money to come through the stimulus package, especially for youth training. So. Is there? Are you developing a particular program around? If you could talk about what you're.
Yeah, we're kind of what we're thinking about. I hope I'm not preempting some of the work that Julia's doing. But Julia and her counterpart in Cortland County, Judy Davison. The interesting thing about the youth program, which has gotten a disproportionate increase in stimulus funding compared to the adult programs, but they redefined youth to include 18 to 24-year-olds. And that's a nice target group for us to be partnering with, because there's a lot of those folks in that age bracket that quite likely might be unemployed, probably never accessed college or any kind of post-secondary education experience and so on. So in essence, what we're talking about, and we're very preliminary proposal stage right now that we're working on to submit to the two WIBs, to fund what I'll characterize, because this board would know what I'm talking about, but to fund a PACE-like program, okay, a person that would be targeted to work and intervene with people in that target audience to provide them that kind of extra support, extra help, extra assistance that they need, more so than maybe a traditional student coming to the college might need. So, and then the funds, I think, also would provide the other kind of support once they access the financial aid kinds of programs that are available, to provide the other kind of support they might need for other costs, like maybe babysitting or transportation or books and things of that sort. So that's kind of what we're looking at, both directors seem to think it's got a lot of upside potential. We'll see how it all works out, but we need to move fairly quickly if we're going to have that in place, so we can then really get the word out and start recruiting people in time for the fall semester. So that's one thing that we're looking at. There's other programs as well. We don't know yet whether the BorgWarner is going to get the Trade Readjustment Act funding, but there appears to be some optimism that maybe on the second try that they might. So that would provide substantial funding for people to be able to come back and attend the college. So there's just a smorgasbord of options there that we need to sort out, but basically I guess I could say we're on the case, and hopefully we'll be able to help a lot of people.
Great, thank you.
Carol, then Leslie, then Frank.
I join the chorus of people, the accolades about what you've achieved in 40 years, and in particular in the last few years. I have a more, a tough times question.
All right.
I'm curious about what you're seeing among your students in terms of particular challenges right now. Are you seeing students who can't afford to continue the rest of the semester? Is it too early in the semester to know whether kids who are graduating just are having no luck finding jobs? Do you have students begging you to stay in another year rather than graduate, given this timing?
No to the first, at least not that I'm aware of, in terms of the students not able to continue. What's hard to know, and perhaps is more pertinent to your point, is the ones that aren't even attempting to come and access, I think, the resources that we could provide them to get some additional educational experiences to help them prepare for a job or whatever. Because between TAP and the Pell programs and that kind of thing, and the Pell, of course, is coming up in terms of its funding at the federal level. I'm not saying that we can totally meet the needs of students. There usually is some unmet need, but usually we're able to accommodate an awful lot of people. But what concerns me more, and that's why I'm kind of excited about this funding that we're getting through WIB, is trying to reach people who believe that they can't take advantage of what we have to offer because of costs or because of prior educational experiences perhaps or whatever. And it's because I think for an awful lot of people, we could be helping an awful lot more people in this community than we are if we could just figure out a way to connect them up. On the job question, that's a good one, and I don't know the answer to that right now. Well, as we head into this recruitment season coming up, we usually by the time we do a survey at graduation for the students that are leaving right about that time period to know whether they have a job or whether they're transferring and whether they have a job in their field or not and that sort of thing. So I'll have that data from last year fairly soon, but I don't have it on the top of my head right now. So, I'll see what I can pick up anecdotally. But I haven't heard that that's an issue, but I don't know.
Thanks, Carl. Leslin?
Carl, I know the chair would love for all of us to stop talking about this. But when we get good stuff come before us, we do want to recognize and encourage. And I want to draw close attention to page 6 of your annual report that speaks of climate. Climate in this sense, referring to inspiring a culture of learning based on an environment of mutual respect, collaboration, transparency, and trust. One of the things that generally gets referred to as just diversity and inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate sort of opening this, looking it from the cover, the obvious, and opening it and seeing some of my colleagues at work who are attending TC3 and knowing that for the next 400 years, because I'll be around, I will probably be attending every TC3 graduation because there'll be some relative of mine who is crossing the stage. I appreciate the work that you all are doing as someone who has a heart and a feeling for diversity and inclusion. I really do appreciate the work. One of the things that I expect I would say that probably will happen is that central point there where you created the DAAC, that the college value of diversity is held as a reference point. I know if any organization or agency is going to move it from being just a reference point to just what we do, it will be TC3. I'm going to hold you all to that standard because I know you can, given some of the conversations I've been involved in, some of the, just discussions we've had around the table, that it's not just going to be that line of sight anymore, but it will just be we do because that's just the right thing to do, and it will set the standard for that. And so I appreciate. I detest seeing annual reports where there's no representation of diversity, not just in what you see, but also what you read.
Mm-hmm.
And so I appreciate that and wanted to point it out.
Well, I've got to give an awful lot of credit to the DAC, the Diversity Equity yeah. Action Council, because the folks that are leading that in the survey on that also have a great passion for what they're doing.
Yep.
And they're the ones that organize this program with the Building Coalition mm-hmm. group. And almost every member of the council went through that. They literally went all day Friday, all day Saturday, and all day Sunday, a three-day program as a train-the-trainer kind of program for continuing that kind of helping us to develop that kind of mutual respect, mutual understanding of people with various differences than we are. And I was just incredibly impressed with the program that these national people came in and provided to us. But I think over the next few years, that's going to kind of ripple around our organization in a very positive way. So great. I'm very encouraged. We have some challenges. Mm-hmm. You know, we still need more diversity in our faculty and staff. We've worked at that, and it seems like every time we take one step forward, we're going a step backward in some way, and that's a real challenge. But our climate, we tend to get pretty good grades when it comes to people feeling that they have been respected, and people from various kinds of cultures and ethnic backgrounds. So that I can feel good about.
If I can add, inclusion matters sometimes a whole lot more than just a visual of diversity.
Yeah.
It's feeling
yeah.
included.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Carl, for bringing the report to us and 40 great years, and being the third president shows what, you know, really what a privilege it is to have such great leaders. So
I can say that on May 2nd, we're going to have a big 40th celebration. I'm sure you'll all be hearing more about that. And on May 1st, we're going to invite some folks from. There's still a few people around from the original board and original county board and so on, and the early boards and so on, where we're going to have a little, what I'm calling a reflections time. So, again, you're welcome to join us for that as well. It should be a fun time. Thank you again.